You know, it's funny because when I first started preaching here was around the same time that me and Mitch had started talking about Jesus together. And every time I'd come back from preaching, I'd ask Mitch, you know, how was it? And he'd say, it sucked. It was terrible. So he'd say, you're not near as passionate when you're preaching as you are when we're talking. It's ridiculous. And he'd get mad at me every time and hold me accountable. And but now I'm getting too intense, I think. So my wife was saying to me, you need to calm down a little bit when you're doing it, right? And my mistake. So, and then I wore gray, and I'm like, I can tell how hard I preach by the sweat stain. So my apologies if you're near the front row and you have to see that. But it's tough because we're still talking about the book of Daniel. And I don't know about you, but I have found the book of Daniel to be incredibly exciting. And today we're looking at Daniel chapter 5. Now, we've been doing this series for a while now, right? We're in the fifth week of it. And we keep driving home the same point again and again and again. And it's based on Daniel's name. Because we're saying there's a significance to Daniel's name. And it's really the significance of the book. Because Daniel's name means what? Sorry, I can't hear that. What was that? God is my only judge. Okay? And this is what we've been pushing and pushing and pushing, trying to say we need to get this into our heart and into our lives. That God renders the verdict on our lives. That He writes the end of our story. And I don't mean like your story one day when you go to heaven. I mean like the story of every day. Like that tough conversation that you need to have that you're saying, well, it's not going to work out right. And I say, false. Let God write the end of that story. Give it a shot. Right? Like these young teenagers in Daniel that we're learning from. That they always have a we'll see attitude when they face fire and lions and all these different things. And even God doesn't just write the end of our story. He writes the end of the whole world's story. And the world's got a lot of bad news going on. So it seems a lot of times. And this gives us a perspective, right? Like if you kept going on in the book of Daniel, you'd see that it's going to tell you the future. Because that future is certain. So the crazy things we learned about Daniel and his friends is that they're these teens who live every day into this kind of reality, that God is their only judge, that He places the verdict on their lives, that He tells the end of their story even before it happens. And what the end result is that these young guys have what we described as reckless faith. They're absolute maniacs. They're crazy people. They're crazy faithful. They face what seems to me as impossible, and they come out victorious with even more courage. So now we're in Daniel chapter 5. And the thing about Daniel chapter 5 is by now Daniel's like super old. He's like 60. Okay? I used that first service, right? And I thought, this is going to get him. And it did, okay? So he's probably, he's like 60, which means that, I don't know, that may even be midlife nowadays. But he's no longer just a teenager that was a slave shipped off to Babylon. Again, he's an older man, and not only is he older now, but he's also a high-ranking official. So he's important. And this guy has seen so much transpire in Babylon, so much so that by this time, you know that guy we talked about last week, Nebuchadnezzar, and he wrote that chapter? Well, Nebuchadnezzar's not even there right now. That's how much time has passed. He's out of the picture. And his son named Belshazzar is now in charge. Okay? So what I'm going to do today is I'm just going to read the whole text, and then I'm going to talk about it. Because I tried like reading the text and talking, and my wife said, "That I love that. That was so good." And then I did it the next time. She said, "I hate that. It's so choppy." So this time, I'm just going to read it. We'll talk about it afterwards. You can hear it as a story. You ready, Cam? King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles, and he drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and the silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned completely pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners, and he said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they couldn't even read the writing or tell what the king meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew even more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "May the king live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind, a knowledge, and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. I think that if you were playing one of those mind-bender games, this guy would be the ultimate teammate. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means." So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father, the king, brought from Judah? I've heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they couldn't explain it. Now, I've heard that you're able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you'll be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you'll be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, just keep the gifts to yourself and give your reward to someone else. Nevertheless, I'll read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. "Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and splendor and glory and greatness." My bad. I mixed up the order. "Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled them. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets them over anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, you haven't humbled yourself, though you knew all of this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles and your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze and iron and wood and stone, which cannot see. They can't even hear, or they can't even understand. But you did not honor the God who holds your very life in his hands, in all of your ways. Therefore, he sent this hand that wrote the inscription." This was the inscription that was written: "Mene, mene, tekel, parson." Here's what those words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then, at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, I hope you were able to hear that big story there, and we're going to track with this thing. But just before we can begin, I got to give you a little bit of context from last week. Now, last week we talked about the king Nebuchadnezzar, and I was saying to you that this guy is the king of pride. He's the very epitome of pride. Because he's the ruler of Babylon, and Babylon is the place where the Tower of Babel happened. And the Tower of Babel was about ascending to heaven. It was about making a great name for oneself. It's really a classic story in the Bible. Everyone knows that story. It's right near the beginning. But the thing is, it's not just a story. And it's not just something that happened way back when. Nebuchadnezzar played out that story each and every day of his life. He was the king of pride. The wild and crazy news that he said to them in this message that I said he was just so cheery about is that God humbled that guy. And he said, this is amazing news. You got to hear this thing. However, somehow his son did not get that message. And so here today we see Belshazzar, his son, repeating classic Babylonian mistakes of building a great name for himself and showing off his towering pride. Now, in the story, you'll notice the first thing he did. Okay, the very first thing this guy does, he's a really young king. I think that this is pretty normal for young kings. I like to think if I had a ton of power, I'd probably do the same thing. And that is that he throws a massive party. I like parties. Okay, this is a good time. And now, we're reading on the PowerPoint from the NIV. And the NIV says that he invited 1,000 of his nobles and he drank wine with them. Now, one of my big rules is you got to read the Bible in multiple translations. Like, Cam only reads in the Message. Tisk, tisk, Cam. I'm just joking. The reason why it does that is to get a different slant on it, okay? Because you need to hear these things. Now, if you read the English Standard Version, which is my pet version, then this is what it says there. It says, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords, and he drank wine in front of 1,000. You see the difference there? So one is, I got a lot. I'm going to throw a party for you guys. The other one is, hey, I'm going to bring all you guys to my party for me. Okay. Which one do you think is more accurate for a king from Babylon? Okay. He invites a bunch of fancy, prestigious people, a whole bunch of them from his kingdom, to celebrate himself. And he did that as a party that's a grand display of who he is. I'm throwing a party next week, but no, I'm sorry. Okay, now, just before you move past that, you got to think about this for a second. Okay, if I was to ask you, hey, do you do that? Do you do that? Well, let me just explain that. I think what Belshazzar is doing is actually something that every one of us does. This is what he's doing, okay? Belshazzar is trying to prove that he is valuable. Okay, that's what he's doing. Because isn't that really the point of pride? Isn't that what pride is all about? At the bottom line, pride is a failure to know what you are worth. Okay? At the bottom line, pride is a failure to know what you are worth. So then you got to go out and start proving it. Right? Tell me what I'm worth. Let me throw a great party and you'll tell me. Oh, I got to have a bigger this thing. Right? I got to have a bigger that thing in my life. I got to advance to this particular level of greatness. My name's got to be shouted out by so-and-so or known by so-and-so because you can't be ordinary. You know, when you got the scroll in your pocket of greatness and you whip that thing out every day, right? It's like, I'm a 5. No one wants to be a 5. What's a 5 on the scale of greatness? That just makes you average. Nobody wants to be average, right? I'm trying to be a 10 on the greatness scale, right? From a level of me to Dan Friebel, I want to be a Dan Friebel. You know what I'm saying? So you got that thing out there and you're comparing and you're measuring and you're doing all these things. Why? Because a 10's valuable. That's somebody important. I don't know, maybe I'm a 1, I'm a 2, something like that. Okay? In order to make your name great, you must ascend. And you must compare to do that. And there has to be somebody on the bottom and somebody on the top. Because you have to prove who you are. And on goes the merry-go-round of Babylon. The first thing that we need to know is that the God who is our only judge is the only one that gets to judge our value. Okay, that's my first point. The God who is our only judge is the judge of our value. Not the imaginary scroll you got in your pocket there. Okay? Now, God's our only judge. The crazy thing is, we don't really believe that. We don't really live into that. But there's freedom when we do. Because the idea of constantly having to prove your worth and ascend to greater and greater heights is the Babylonian life. It's the Babel invention. And it makes you the sole judge of your own value. Even worse, it can make the gods of Babylon the judge of your value. Listen, every pagan god is a slave trader every time. Okay? No pagan god thought human beings were worth anything. They deal in slavery. And if you follow them, you will never be enough. You can never do enough because you're not worth anything to them. Now, you can even, this is a biblical, you know, a big biblical story thing. You can go all the way back to Egypt. The people of God working for Pharaoh, who works for a pagan god. And what's the thing? With Pharaoh, when you build the bricks, you know, I say, okay, I need 50 bricks. You put out 50 bricks. What's the next thing he says? Good job, guys. He's like, you need more bricks. And then he says 100. You put out 100. What does he say? 200. You can never build enough bricks for a pagan god. They're slave traders. And it'll always be one more brick. And if you follow them, it ends in death. Do you ever feel that pressure that you need to prove yourself again and again and to say you're worth it? You see, the sign that you're not allowing the God of the Bible, the God of Christianity, to be the only judge of your value is that you feel constant pressure that you must prove who you are, to prove that you're worth it. It's time for us to truly take a step back, okay? Because Nebuchadnezzar said, God dealt with my heart. This is a cheerful thing. And maybe it's time for us to take a look at ourselves and think, what God do I truly worship? Now, we often throw around the term God, right? People ask this question all the time. Do you believe in God? And my answer to that is, that's a terrible question. Because what God are you talking about? Are you talking about the slave trader? Are you talking about a God of grace? Are you talking about the God we find in Jesus? Which God are we talking about here? It's not do you believe in God, it's which God do you believe in. And that's my second point here. This is like the litmus test, okay? Now, I can't even remember what this was. First service I was saying, I'm reading about that gas that can be in your basement, in your house. You know, a bunch of people had it in Calgary, it caused lung cancer. What's that called? Does anybody know? Radon, okay? My mom keeps saying, you need a radon detector because you can't smell the stuff. There's no like signs that's in there. You just need a radon detector. And you need some way to detect these things in your life, okay? Because what God you worship, it's sometimes very hard to detect. So we need some kind of detector for that. And here's the detector. This is what it is. You are worshiping whatever is determining your worth. Okay? It's not a question, okay? You are worshiping whatever is determining your worth. Now, notice that when Belshazzar wants to prove his worth, he makes a show of all of his valuables. He takes out the gold and the silver goblets that his father had plundered from the Jerusalem temple. He sets up this huge spread of enormous banquet. In this huge banquet hall that's made of bronze and iron, wood and stone, and he puts it all on display. Look at the size of my greatness. And that guy's got a lot of nice stuff. And he stands at the center of it all. And when Daniel confronts the king, he says that Belshazzar worships the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. You notice that? As he said, that's who you worship. Now, I don't think Belshazzar would have thought of himself as worshiping those things. Because we actually know from history what are the names of the Babylonian gods. And they aren't the name gold, silver, bronze, stone, none of those things. Okay? These are their names. Nebo and Bel. Does that ring something in your ear? Nebo. Is there any character in the book that kind of sounds like that? Yeah, finding Nemo is a good point, okay? And we have found Nemo. Nebo in this case, and his name is Nebuchadnezzar, right? Now, there's the other god's name's Bel. Does anyone in the story sound like that? Who's that? Yeah. One of the Belshazzars. You like, because it's hard to say them, okay? Belshazzar. I screw them up all the time. These guys are named after the names of the gods. You don't generally do that. Like, notice none of us named our kid Jesus. It's an arrogant thing to do, okay? So it's the names of the gods are the same as the names of the king. But my point is, that is the names of their gods, okay? So when he wants to prove his worth, he puts his valuables on display. Now, when he puts his valuables on display, do you think he would still worship Bel and Nebo if those valuables were taken away? Okay. Do you think he would still worship Bel and Nebo if those things were taken away? Because what's the judge of his value? That's his God, and that's what Daniel says. You see, when we worship something cold, hard, and impersonal, like possessions, okay? And this isn't something for rich people. It's not like, whoa, I know that guy can do that, okay? Because I have been here many times, okay? Now, the thing is, when we worship our possessions, the problem is this. Daniel points out, he says, listen, those gods, they can't see you. They can't see. They don't have eyes. They're not like the true God. And this is what David says. David says that the true God, his thoughts of us are like sand on the seashore. A God who sees us every moment of every day. Every moment from the day we're born, like Cam said. Every moment he's thinking about you. He can't take his eyes off you because he's absolutely captured by love for you. That's not a 21st century invention, right? That isn't something we say, well, we're really selfish in the 21st century, so we came up with that. That's David. He's the one saying that. God can't stop looking at you. He can't take his eyes off you. The problem is your possessions don't have eyes. They don't look at you like that. And when you worship something wishy-washy, unfaithful and fickle, like social media status or social status in any arena, the problem is that God can't hear you. It doesn't have ears. It can't hear your tears in the night when you don't think you can measure up, and when you haven't measured up, and you're low, because we all get there. And you wonder, does anyone honestly think that I'm valuable? Does anyone really want that part of me that I want to give? Or maybe someone mistreated you and told you that you have no value, and it seeps into your heart even though you try and keep it out, because you can't help but wonder, is that actually true? What am I worth? Now these gods can't hear you. They can't see you. But the true God can. And if you think back to what Daniel and his buddies grew up with, they would know the story of the Exodus, of Passover. And what that story says is that the God of the Bible hears the cries of the lowly, the slaves, the cattle of the ancient world, they cry out. They don't even know the God they're crying out to. And he comes down and delivers them. He hears the cries of those who have been told that they have no value. And he values them. These false gods, they can't understand who you are. Daniel says they have no understanding. They don't know what you've been through. They don't know how you got there. They don't know what your plans for your future are. But God can. He does understand you. David says that he knit us together in our mother's womb, that he knows everything about us because he handcrafted us. Right? It's not math. It's because he dwells on you. And he's so invested in us that David says he actually knows our thoughts. That's because he listens. He hears your thoughts one at a time. And Daniel says, listen, Belshazzar, here you are, you're worshiping gold and silver and bronze and iron and stone, and you don't even understand because you want to be great. You want to be huge. You want to be powerful. And yet the whole time of your life, you lived it in the palm of God's hand. It turns out God's slightly bigger. And what I want to say to you is, let the God who knows you, who hears you, and who sees you determine your value. And no other God ever. You know, kids are amazing at this. Okay, here's where I'm going to bring it on the ground to you so you can see that this is absolutely true. I love watching kids. Okay? And this is the biggest thing. Like, we get to babysit Luther in Milan a lot of times. What a great blessing. First, I kind of stayed on the outskirts, you know, like, man, these kids are kind of, kids are crazy. What are they going to do next? And then slowly I start coming in. Now I'm the dragon and they ride me across the living room and stuff. Okay? And the thing is, I love watching kids. They're so much fun what they can do in a box. Okay? But you know what's even more true than that I love watching kids? Kids love being watched. Am I right? Okay, now parents, you're going to have to let me know. Okay? I'm not a parent. So you have to let me know, and it's hard to hear from on the stage. Now, literally everything a kid does begins with this. Mommy, watch me do this. Okay? Daddy, watch me do this. And it literally can be anything. Okay? This was the other day. I'm not even the mommy and daddy to these kids. This is what they said, like, Ryan, watch me do this. Okay? That's what they said. Watch me do this. And it always ends with this. You know when they land? Because it's da-da-da! And then what are they looking for? The reason why they ask is because they want to soak in the praise. Because the correct response that I'm supposed to say is, that's amazing! You jumped off the couch! Right? I absolutely love it. They're soaking in the value. Like, oh, I'm just going to jump all day. And then they just keep jumping, you know, and eventually I'm like, okay, let's stop. But then they want to play dragon, so we have to go back to jumping. So, now this is the next thing. You know why kids want their parents to watch what they do? It's because, this is the secret, okay? It's because they think you value them. That's what it is. They have this always anticipation that their parents want to see what they do, think it's absolutely amazing. It's wonderful. And then they just take in that value. It's what fuels them. And you know where kids learn this? They learn it because they were babies before. If you don't think babies are learning something, I'm telling you, they are learning because it goes on. Okay? What happens when a baby takes a first step? Have you ever seen a baby take a first step? Yeah? Okay, so what really happens? This sounds like you just sit there. What happens? Okay, there we go. Maybe you post it on YouTube so everyone in the world can. A baby took a step. This is the first baby that's ever taken a step. It's so wonderful. Okay? Now, I don't mean to be crass here, okay? I'm not trying to be crass. This is just true. Okay? You can tell me it's true. I swear that all a baby has to do to get praised is poop their pants. Am I right? Okay? That is not being crass. It's absolutely true because it's like you're worried. Is this baby congested? And then suddenly the baby poops its pants and then it's like, oh my goodness, they pooped their pants. And then you know what parents do afterwards? Then they grab this child and they hold them and they kiss them and they just love on them. And it's absolutely amazing. And what I want to say is this. This comes back to my rule from before that we're not better parents than God. This is what it is. God is like that. God values us not because of what we have done, but it's because it is who he is. Okay, this is the crazy thing that, the Bible's telling us is this. God is love. And the point of that is this. If you had a friend named Bob, and you're like, yeah, Bob's love. That's who Bob is. Wouldn't it be weird if Bob didn't love somebody? You'd be like, then Bob isn't love, is he? That's odd. This is the thing. God is love. So the weird thing is if he doesn't love somebody. That's who he is. Okay, this is my final proof of it, okay? You guys remember Jesus' baptism? He's an important character in the Bible, okay? Now, there's this time when Jesus is baptized. He comes up out of the water and he's filled with the Holy Spirit. And God the Father, his dad, says to him, son, now your test begins, okay? And I expect 10 out of 10 because I'm a perfect father. And listen, son, if you get a 10, I'm going to love you. But you better not fall short, right? You remember that story?
No.
Well, jeepers, I obviously read it wrong, okay? This is what the dad of this little boy says to him. He comes up out of the water filled with power for his mission, and his dad says, this is my beloved son, and I am so pleased with him. And that's before he's even done anything. Before Jesus even starts his mission, the Father gives him all the fuel for it. He says, I'm proud of you, son. Before you begin, you go with my blessing. And what was Jesus' response to that? You remember how he responded to it? He said, I'm the Son of God. I don't need this. And then he just went on living his life, right? No. No, even Jesus needed to know that his Father loved him without him having to prove that he deserved it. Why don't we as adults just admit that we want God to think we're awesome? And that really deep down, we're just gigantic children. And we want to hear God say, that was such a good job. Right? You do something in your life and you say, Dad, look at what I did. And he says, do it again. I can't get enough of that. Why don't we admit that? Because I'll tell you what, if you say to God, God, will you? I just need you to tell me that I'm doing something in my life. You know, tell me you love me. You know what he will do? He'll do it. He's an encourager. And then you know what happens? You do something in your life, like you forgive somebody and you say, God, did you see that? That was amazing. That obviously came from you. I can't believe I did this. Right? You take these baby steps in your faith. You say, God, did you see it? And he says, I saw it. I saw it. And I'm so proud of you, son. I'm so proud of you, daughter. And then we take all that in and we take it in. And then we say to him, we say, I love you. I absolutely love you, Dad. You're the best dad ever. You're always willing to pour out praise on me. You're always willing to give me your love. And you know what that's called when we do that? That's called worship. If you're stumbling around in your worship, you know, and you think, I don't have fuel for that fire, begin with humility and say, God, can you pour something into me? Can you tell me you love me today? You tell me you're proud of me today. Because that is humility, right? We don't need to be more bigger than Jesus. Jesus is dad. Tell me you love me. Boom. Got it. Okay? Take it in from him and then give it back to him in praise. That'll amp up your worship. You see, we need to learn to let this God be the judge of our value. It's not worth it to worship anything else or anyone else. Do you feel you have to constantly prove yourself? Do you often feel insecure? What are you worshiping? Because that thing you are worshiping or that person you are worshiping, or that image of who you should be that you're worshiping, it is determining your value. Don't let it. Let me just bring this thing to a close here. You see, Daniel's been in Babylon for a long time now. He's seen the games of pride and power and the merry-go-round of Babylon be played over and over. And I'm sure you noticed his response. Belshazzar had said to him, listen, if you can do this crazy thing, man, if you can read the writing on the wall, I'm going to make you great, and I'm going to give you an even higher position. You're going to have all this power. And Daniel's response is, I've heard that one before. You just keep your rewards to yourself, man. I'll just help you anyway. Did you notice that? Daniel has seen the games of Babylon again and again. And he's sick of playing them. He wants nothing to do with it anymore because he doesn't need to prove himself. You see, Daniel knew his worth because he knew who he worshiped. He didn't need to prove himself because God, this God alone, was his judge. God alone determined his value. And what I want to say to you today is, folks, just let that be the writing on your wall. Just let that be the writing on your wall. Let it say this: God alone is my judge. Only he can determine my value. Amen. God, I want to thank you that the radically good news of the New Testament is that you don't need us to prove ourselves to you. In fact, you despise that game. It's the game of Babylon. And it leads to anywhere between a 1 and a 10 in comparison and judgment and pushing down others and propping ourselves up. But God, there is something you're into. And it's what the New Testament is screaming at us, and it turns out it goes all the way back to the Old Testament, and that's this. We don't need to prove ourselves to you because, God, you seek to prove yourself to us. That you want us to know who you are. That you are love. And God, one day you're going to win. God, one day we're going to believe it. God, one day we'll throw away our scrolls of counting. And we will learn the message of Corinthians that's read at every wedding that says that love doesn't keep a record. Love doesn't compare. It just lavishes on the beloved. God, may we live as your beloved people. May we worship no other God ever. And may you become the Lord of every facet of our lives. Amen.